You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest wrote a new book about impeachment and the American Constitution. He'll tell us how it works, when it applies, and more. Now, after examining more than 30,000 misdemeanor cases over 7 years, a legal researcher has found that white defendants in Wisconsin are offered more favorable plea deals than African Americans. And the difference is not a small one. In fact, white defendants were more than 74% more likely than their black counterparts to have all charges that could lead to prison time dropped, dismissed, or reduced. Carlos Berdejo is a professor of law and J. Howard Zeman Fellow at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Part of his research has focused on understanding how judges and prosecutors make decisions and exercise their discretion. Carlos, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Well, I want to start by talking about the importance of these plea deals. I think we think in the lay public about a court case ending with that big decision from the jury, the sentence from the judge. Plea deals, they are a much more common occurrence, it sounds like. Is that right?
That is true. The reality is that the vast majority of cases are adjudicated via a plea deal where the defendant and the prosecutor agree to a charge to which the defendant pleads guilty. And then the judge, based on that crime to which the defendant has pled guilty, then imposes a sentence. So the process is a little bit less dramatic and it's less public than what you would expect based on TV shows and the like.
And who has the most power to decide what kind of plea gets offered?
The prosecuting attorney has a lot of discretion when it comes to deciding which charges to file against the defendant and then whether to offer a plea agreement.
And what has past research shown about racial disparities in charges and sentencing and pleas, if there's that kind of research out there in plea bargains?
So there is some research. There's not as much as you would hope there is, and I can get to the reasons why later on. But there is some research at both at the federal and state level, and some of the research at the state level has been inconclusive, but some of it shows that there are disparities that disfavor black defendants. And at the federal level, there is also evidence that black defendants receive, for example, more severe initial charges than white defendants.
And now you studied plea deals for us here in Wisconsin. First of all, what led you to focus on Wisconsin in your research?
So Wisconsin is an interesting state to study this because you guys are very transparent. So the data, most states or the states that have data on criminal cases, they only have data on that, like, final sentencing decision made by the judge. So they'll have the crime for which the defendant was convicted, which often is the result of a plea agreement, and then the sentence that the judge imposed based on that conviction offense. But Wisconsin has data that allows you to look at not just the sentencing stage, but also the preceding stages, including the plea bargaining stage.
So we might not know from other states, you know, if I go in charge with a particular misdemeanor and my neighbor does too, we end up with different charges. That first step would have been invisible in a lot of other states. It's not here in Wisconsin. Do I have that right?
Yes. Yes, and also how you and your neighbor, those two different cases, sort of move along the system. So if your neighbor gets a charge reduction, but you do not, you could observe that in Wisconsin with the data. In other states, that whole process that precedes conviction is quite opaque.
So you studied the life cycle here, different people coming in with charges, what happened to them through the process, what pleas happened, what charges were filed. What did you see when it came to racial disparities here in Wisconsin?
So what you observe is that white defendants are more likely than black defendants to receive a charge reduction. That is, to have their initial top charge reduced through the plea bargaining process. So, yeah. And that finding is robust to including a number of controls to account for differences in the defendant prior criminal history or gender, and also type of case and severity of the crime.
Let's suppose you said you controlled for a past criminal background. African-American defendant versus a white defendant, both of them don't have a criminal record. They have not been charged before. What kind of differences, what kind of disparities did you see in how they were treated?
So a real interesting pattern is that those differences that we observe, even after controlling for a number of factors, are stronger in cases that you could think of as being low-information cases. Cases, for example, in which the defendants have no prior criminal history, no prior convictions, and also cases involving less severe offenses, such as misdemeanors or very low-level felonies.
So for more violent crimes or people with more established criminal backgrounds, there's less of a disparity? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, they are more likely for offenders that have a prior criminal record or that are accused of committing a high-level felony. You see less of a disparity between black and white defendants. So most of the disparity is concentrated on those misdemeanors, low-level felonies, and cases involving defendants with no prior criminal record.
So it sounds like then that white suspect with no criminal record, they're more likely, in effect, to get a second chance. They're more likely to come out of this
exactly
with less or no punishment. Is that right?
Yeah, so what we observe is that when you look at defendants that have no prior criminal records, white defendants are more likely to get a second chance from the prosecutor than black defendants. And that finding is consistent with some theoretical models that say that race may be used subconsciously as a factor to assess the risk that a defendant poses in terms of committing future crimes or committing more serious crimes in the future.
As we wrap up, do you have thoughts on how to close this imbalance, how to treat those first-time offenders in particular more equally?
I believe that one of the big takes from this paper is the need for transparency. So if we have more information on those decisions being made by prosecutors, then prosecutors can be held accountable, both internally within the prosecutor's offices, but also externally by the courts and outside researchers. And I think that once we understand how those decisions are made, and we are able to hold prosecutors accountable, just like we hold judges accountable, then the system can be legitimized in the eyes of more people.
Carlos, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Carlos Berdejo is professor of law and J. Howard Zeman Fellow at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. He joined us to talk about racial differences in plea bargaining in Wisconsin criminal cases. Coming up, a law professor tells us about impeachment, why it was an important concept to the American founders, how it worked, and some common misconceptions. Stay with us here on Central Time. The mechanism of impeachment is laid out in the U.S. Constitution, but it doesn't come up too often, especially when it comes to U.S. presidents. Bill Clinton, Richard Nixon, and Andrew Johnson found themselves staring at the wrong end of impeachment proceedings, and there have been movements toward impeaching other presidents that sputtered out. Now a few Democrats in the U.S. House are considering filing articles of impeachment. One actually did so in July. But what is impeachment? How does it work? Why is it a part of our Constitution? Cass Sunstein is a professor at Harvard Law School. He's the author of the new book, Impeachment, A Citizen's Guide. Cass, thanks a lot for joining us today.
A pleasure to be here. All thanks to you.
How important was impeachment to the founders?
Indispensable. Without impeachment, there's a good argument we wouldn't have had a constitution at all. It was a necessary response to the argument that the powerful presidency was a return to something for which the American Revolution had been fought.
You're right that there was concern that we would have an elected monarch to replace the hereditary monarch of England.
Completely. So under the Articles of Confederation, which followed the successful American Revolution, we didn't have a powerful executive at all, nothing like a president. And so once there was a decision that Hamilton actually helped yield, that is to have a powerful president, the idea was we need to have some mechanism by which we ensure that we, the people, are ultimately in charge in case there is corruption or lawlessness or something terrible. And impeachment is that mechanism.
A big deal then, but you write that impeachment is poorly understood today, sometimes even by members of Congress, the people who would have to put it into action. Why do we not get impeachment now?
Well, one reason is actually fortunate, which is that we haven't had to resort to it much. So if things are working well, it's kind of a thing we have in our pocket that we don't have to take out. And if you don't have to take it out, you don't have to look at it. Another reason is the key term, high crimes and misdemeanors, sounds like a reference to violation of the criminal law. So a modern reader, you might think, well, if the president commits a crime, then he's impeachable. If not, not. That's not really what they were talking about, but it is a tempting modern rendition. And another view is it's just a political thing, as then Congressman Gerald Ford said. And so the kind of constitutional backdrop disappears. We think, what are the politics? That's really where all the action is.
Right. The thought seems to be sometimes that the president would have to knock over a liquor store or something to be eligible for impeachment. Can you talk about the things that it's really there for as you're looking at it in the Constitution?
Sure. If the president knocked over a liquor store, by the way, that would be very sad and reason for thinking what is going on, but probably wouldn't be impeachable for that. What they're talking about with impeachment is not like ordinary crimes, but large-scale abuses of presidential authority. So when you think about impeachment, kind of the best way in is to read the Declaration of Independence. That was against the backdrop of the Americanization of impeachment, which happened in the preceding decades. And it's a bill, it's like Articles of Impeachment, the Declaration is, a bill of particulars referring to abuses of authority. So if the president decides I'm going to abridge liberty, I'm going to start locking people up because of their religion or their political conviction, that's not a crime, but that is a high crime and misdemeanor in the constitutional sense. If the president abuses the pardon power in a terrible way by pardoning people who were involved with the president personally in criminality, and that's like a very extreme case, James Madison said abuse of the pardon power is an impeachable offense. So when you think about impeachment, think about terrible abuses of public trust or of the authority the president has. And it doesn't really matter if the offense that is the basis for impeachment is a technical violation of the criminal law.
You give a bunch of different cases, 21, I think, looking at ones that might cross the line into impeachability, ones that shouldn't, and some middle ground cases. Some of the ones you look at that seem a little tougher relate to incompetence, negligence of presidential duties, that kind of thing. That really could be a ground for impeachment?
I don't think so. So if the president, you know, has a bad year and makes a bunch of foolish decisions, that's not a high crime and misdemeanor. If the president is just doing the job really poorly and things are going sour, well, that's what elections do. They have consequences. So think with impeachment about what Alexander Hamilton referred to as abuses of public trust, and think of that as something like you know, not respecting freedom or about going to war for reasons that aren't in the ballpark of the warranted or of conspiring with another country for ends that are not in the interest of we the people here in the United States. That's the kind of thing we're thinking about. Terrible uses of the FBI and the CIA would be impeachable offenses. And by terrible, I mean using them in a way that abridges liberty or that involves self-dealing on the president's part and compromises the enterprise of self-government, which was really a theory that was had caught fire in the 18th century here at home.
We're talking to Cass Sunstein, professor at Harvard Law School. His new book is Impeachment, A Citizen's Guide. Cass, talk us through the procedure, the process. What would have to happen for a president to be impeached?
It's set out with some specificity in the Constitution. So the first institution that acts is the House of Representatives. And the way, by tradition, that operates is there's Articles of Confederation, Articles of Impeachment that are drafted. And the articles will specify the high crimes and misdemeanors that are the ground for impeaching the commander-in-chief. So it might say, you know, he violated the income tax laws. That, by the way, is not an impeachable offense. So that's not a good ground. But it might say that he abused the war power. And now we're talking. That's more in the ballpark. And there's a list. And then that's voted on standardly by a committee in the House of Representatives, Judiciary Committee, very good candidate. And if there's a majority there, then it goes to the full House. And if there's a majority there, then the president is impeached. So that's by a majority vote in the House of Representatives. That does not mean, importantly, that the president has to leave office. It's in the nature of an indictment. So after the president has been impeached, then the Senate, acting for the only time, really, as a court, the Senate conducts a trial and decides whether to convict the president. And a conviction has to occur by a two-thirds majority. And if that happens, then the president is out. If not, the president is besmirched because he's been impeached, but he still gets to be president.
And you said earlier that it's incorrect to view this, to think of this as a partisan political tool, in theory anyway, but in practical reality, would a party really go after a president from their own party?
Could happen. So I have, you know, enough faith in the robustness of our democracy that if something truly egregious happened, party would become less important than patriotism, and we'd see a weakening of partisan ties. But it is true in hard cases, and you can characterize the Nixon and Clinton ones as hard cases. A lot of people thought they were. Partisanship will play a role, and they played a big role there. By the way, the Nixon impeachment was completely legitimate. There were fair grounds for finding high crimes and misdemeanors, not in all of the articles, but in some of them. The Clinton impeachment was not, and that is a very big disparity, those two. In both of them, partisanship played a role, but to the credit of the Republicans, enough of them shifted in the Nixon matter that it looked like impeachment was overwhelming and overwhelmingly likely, and a number of Republicans were for it.
And you also write in the book about the 25th Amendment alternative, which is different than the impeachment procedure we've been talking about, but the effect is the same, removing the president. What would happen?
Okay, so think of the 25th Amendment as about conditions rather than about actions. So the kind of precipitating event for the 25th Amendment was the assassination of President Kennedy, and the thought was we need kind of clarity if the president lives in a terrible either medical scare or, God forbid, assassination attempt, and is alive, but who's going to perform the job? And what the 25th Amendment does, if the president has a condition that makes it unable for him to do the job, it could be a mental condition, by the way, if there's crippling depression or anxiety or something like that, the 25th Amendment's available for that. The mechanism is the vice president and the cabinet, by majority vote, have to decide whether the president's able to do the job. And it's supposed to be a neutral kind of medical type inquiry. Of course, if there's intense loyalty on the part of the vice president and the cabinet, which is likely, there'll be a real burden on those who want to say the president's unable to do the job. But it is a fully available mechanism for kind of policy neutral, even act neutral, incapacitation.
And Cass, as we start to wrap up, part of what you're hoping to do is clear up misconceptions about impeachment, what it is, how it works. What are the most important things that we get wrong when it comes to impeachment?
I think there are two. The one error that is all over, and Congresswoman Pelosi, you know, has been around a long time. It's revealing that she made the mistake, was to say impeachment is about crimes. It's kind of doubly not right, given the historical evidence. There are plenty of crimes that just aren't impeachable. If the president shoplifts or jaywalks or even cheats on his income tax, that's not good. But that's not what high crimes and misdemeanors are about. And I think more fundamentally, if the president does something terrible, given the nature of his job, he can be impeached if it's an abuse of authority, even if it's not a crime. So if the president says, I'm just going to pardon people who hurt people of color because, you know, so some lives don't matter, that's completely impeachable, even though that exercise of the pardon power wouldn't be a crime. So the focus on criminality as both necessary for an impeachable offense and as sufficient for an impeachable offense, I think that's error number one.
And error number, you said there were two big ones, just briefly?
Yeah. The other one is to think that the House of Representatives gets to decide what an impeachable offense is. Not so. The founders fought very hard to make sure that we would have terrible actions being the basis for impeachment and not policy disagreement or partisanship or dissatisfaction.
We'll leave it there for now, Cass. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. A pleasure.
That's Harvard Law Professor Cass Sunstein. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Impeachment, A Citizen's Guide. Coming up, humans are largely to blame for climate change. That, according to a new report from the U.S. government, we'll learn what's at stake, a possible consequences of climate change by region, by city in some cases, and what could change, what opportunities there are to deal with the problem. We'll talk to a co-author of that report. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Humans are the single biggest cause of climate change, according to a new report from the U.S. government. This is due in large part to the continued use of fossil fuels and increased deforestation. The report comes amid months of severe and unusual weather, including flooding, hurricanes, and wildfires throughout the United States and the world. And its release was approved by the White House, though it contradicts the Trump administration's stance on climate change. Catherine Hayhoe joins us now. She's a professor of atmospheric sciences at Texas Tech University and a lead author of this new government report on climate change. Catherine, thanks for joining us today on Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, one takeaway, if you want the public to know one thing about this report, what are you hoping we learn from it?
Well, this report is hundreds of pages long, but it can be summarized in one sentence. Climate is changing, humans are responsible, the risks are real, and the window of time to fix this thing is closing fast.
And this is similar to past comparable reports and a lot of research. Is there anything that's new that maybe surprised you in your findings?
Well, the bottom line, that climate is changing, that we're responsible, and that we need to fix this thing, we've known that for decades. It's been over 50 years since scientists first felt confident enough about this to formally warn a U.S. president. But there is a lot of new things that we've also been learning. And many of the new things that we've been learning point to this being more serious even than we initially thought in terms of how quickly the oceans are warming, how fast the Arctic and the Antarctic are melting, how a changing climate is affecting our weather patterns. This thing is a big deal.
And part of what you do in your own research, I know, is to look not just at the big picture, but how a region might be affected, or a city, or even an airport might be affected by climate change. What kind of changes are we seeing on the ground at a more local level, and are we expecting to see?
Well, this is a big global problem, of course, but the reason why we care about it is because it affects the places where we live. And depending on where we live, we care about a changing climate because it takes the natural risks that we already face and it exacerbates them. So if we live in a place that is already prone to hurricanes, as cities are if they're along the Gulf Coast, we care about climate change because it's making our hurricanes stronger and it's bringing more rainfall associated with those hurricanes. But of course, if we live in Wisconsin, hurricanes are not what we worry about. We're concerned about heavy rainfall events because we've seen a huge increase, not just across the whole country, but especially in the Midwest. We care about summer heat. We care about pests and invasive species moving northward, not just land-based species, but ones that affect our water, too. We care about the risks that we're used to, that we've already faced in the past, but many of those risks are being exacerbated by a changing climate.
And part of putting out a report like this is that there's still a lot of opposition to the idea that the climate is changing. People say, well, there's still winter in some places, so really is the climate warming up? What is your message for people who don't buy the whole concept?
Yes, we hear that a lot. Between November and April, probably the most frequent question is, it's cold outside, where's global warming now? And of course, we're not talking about what's happening from one day to the next. That's weather. We're talking about what's happening over 20 to 30 years. And no matter where we look, we see that over climate timescales, the planet is definitely warming. It's kind of like as if you were on the Titanic, and the Titanic was sinking, and you're like, well, it can't be sinking because my end just went 200 feet up in the air. You have to look at the big picture when you're seeing how things are changing. But when we actually start talking about this issue, we soon realize that our main problem is not the science, because the science that we use to study this thing, it's been around for decades, even centuries. Our problem, most of us, is with the perceived solutions. We feel that if we say, yes, this thing is real and we have to fix it, then the government's going to come in and set our thermostat, take away our truck, legislate what type of light bulbs we are or aren't allowed to put in our own homes, destroy the economy, and basically turn the entire country into a second world nation. Those are the perceived solutions. Of course, the truth is exactly the opposite, but who would want to live in a world like that? So often we find there's more positive momentum and we can really connect and agree more when we're talking about solutions that invest in the local economy, that grow the economy, that make the U.S. competitive, that build jobs, all kinds of things like that.
Talking to Catherine Hayhoe. She's an atmospheric scientist and a professor at Texas Tech University. She's a lead author on this newly released federal report on climate change. Catherine, I want to get into those solutions in just a minute, but kind of at the opposite end of the spectrum from people who say, no, there is no climate change, are people who maybe feel a sense of doom. Climate change is here. It's too late. There's nothing we can do about it.
Yes, and that can be just as harmful because when we give up hope, we're paralyzed, you know? And the foundation of action is hope, the hope for a better future. It's true that some amount of the impacts are inevitable. It's as if we've been smoking a pack of cigarettes a day for years and even decades. But at the same time, when's the best time to stop smoking? Today. If we can't stop today, tomorrow. There is hope. We can avert the most serious and dangerous impacts if we act swiftly. And the good news is other countries are already acting. China leads the world in the most installed wind and solar energy of any country. They are shutting down coal-fired power plants now, not building one a day anymore. India has the cheapest prices for solar energy. They're setting records. Even where I live in Texas, last year we got 12% of our energy from wind. The first quarter of this year, we got 23% of our energy from wind. The world is changing. We've got Chinese wind companies coming into Wyoming, retraining U.S. coal miners who are out of work to do wind energy installations. The boulder's already rolling downhill. It just has to roll a little faster. And for that, we need all hands on board.
Let's talk more about that solution side. You were talking about local initiatives that can be economically productive, not sort of a let's go back to the dark ages sort of mentality. Can you talk more about what local government, state governments, and private entrepreneurs, for that matter, are doing at the local level?
Mm-hmm. So this is straying very far, obviously, from the content of our climate science report, because when you look at the science, there's really not a lot of hope. There's just concern and even alarm when you look at what's happening to this planet. But when you look at the growth of the clean energy economy, there is a lot of hope there. Because if we installing wind, installing solar energy is a way to invest in local economies, there's far more people now employed in the solar industry than the coal industry today. The world is changing. It's changing in Africa, it's changing in India, it's changing in China, and it's even changing here to the point where we can have a hope for a better future by investing in clean energy and by gradually, not suddenly, but gradually weaning ourselves off old ways of getting energy that we've been using for hundreds of years. And amazingly, by doing this, it'll cut air pollution, which kills 200,000 people in the United States every year, just plain old dirty air pollution from burning fossil fuels. It grows local economies. It makes us energy independent, which increases national security, and it fixes climate change at the same time.
Let's get more into the science of the report and the findings. The report finds it reconfirms that humans are driving the climate change we're seeing in the world now. Which of our behaviors, fossil fuels, I assume, are a biggie, that and what else is driving climate change?
Well, burning fossil fuels, coal, gas, and oil, is the primary reason for climate change. But when we break that down by sector, we see that part of the challenge of addressing this issue is it isn't just one thing. So agriculture is responsible for about a quarter of the problem. All of the energy we use in agriculture, as well as all the methane produced by cows and sheep, most of it out the front end, a little bit out the back. Transportation is responsible for about a quarter. Our buildings and our infrastructure about a quarter. And then industry is responsible for about a quarter. So this issue is spread across all sectors of the economy, and that's why we really need these comprehensive solutions, like putting a price on carbon, like investing in the clean energy economy. That's why we need these solutions, because we can't just say, oh, well, we're going to fix coal-fired power plants, and then we'll be done. That is absolutely an important piece, but it's not sufficient.
In your report, did you look at tipping points where people talk about as things thaw and melt in northern latitudes, you'll see more methane release, things like that, are where we might hit a point where climate change really takes off and gets worse faster?
Yes, that was one of the most unique aspects of our report. We have an entire chapter, chapter 15, if anyone's interested. Chapter 15 talks about the possibility of surprise and how all of the signs are pointing to if a surprise happens, it's more likely than not to be an unpleasant surprise compared to a pleasant surprise. There are aspects of the climate system that we know if we look back through distant time, that if you push them too hard, they can flip us into a different state. There are massive amounts of methane trapped in the permafrost in the Arctic and even in the continental shelf that if it got warm enough to release could push us into conditions that have never been seen in the history of human civilization on this planet. We care about a changing climate because we have built our infrastructure, our cities, our economy, our agriculture, our water and food and energy systems. We have built them on the assumption of a stable climate. Two-thirds of the world's biggest cities are within just a few feet of sea level, and we are looking at least a few feet of sea level rise this century. That's why we care.
We're talking to Catherine Hayhoe right now. She's an atmospheric science and a professor at Texas Tech University, one of the authors of the latest federal government report on climate change. The report states that humans have had the biggest negative impact on the Earth's climate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? What do you think of this news? What steps would you like to see people, business, government take to reduce the impact of climate change? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about climate change and the human impact on rising temperatures on the planet. Catherine Hayhoe is with us. She's an atmospheric scientist and a professor in the Political Science Department at Texas Tech University. She was a lead author on a U.S. government report released last week that said, among other things, that humans have had the biggest negative impact on the Earth's climate. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the report? Do you think it'll make a difference in policy, in behavior? What questions do you have about climate change? What steps, if any, do you think we should be taking? Call in at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Catherine, you were talking about surprises just a few moments ago. And I've seen, at least in some cases, to the extent that projections about climate change have been wrong, they've been wrong because things got worse faster than we expected. Is that something you've seen happening as you looked at this new report, as you put this together?
Yes. There's a common myth going around that, oh, those models are wrong. They're always going to say something's happening and it's never happened. But we can go back three decades looking at projections that models have made, and they are pretty much right on when it looks at tracking global temperature and how that's responding to the choices that we have made on how we get our energy. But when we start looking at the regional level and we start looking at specific aspects of our Earth system, like the Antarctic ice sheets, for example, there we see things changing faster than we thought. So if anything, there is substantial evidence that in certain parts of the world, the models are not right on. They are actually underestimating the rate of change. And that's why I said earlier, when we look at the science, there's not a lot of good news in the science.
Let's go to our callers now. Bill is on the line in Fitchburg. Bill, hi.
Hey there. Catherine, I want to thank you. I think you're explaining so well. Just really appreciate you. I was at the AGU conference. It's a American Geophysical Union gathering in 2007, and they talked about, well, I saw the graphs, and they were all exponential, which is, you know, faster than expected. 10 years later, you know, we're starting to see this. I think we have to do everything we can possibly do, and I agree with everything you've been saying, but being in the government, how much looking into geoengineering, you know, sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere.
Bill,
you know,
thanks for bringing that up. This concept of geoengineering, it's interventions, not just cutting climate change emissions, I guess, but changing the atmosphere on purpose. What kind of did you get into geoengineering in this report, first of all, Catherine?
Yes, we only mention it very slightly because this report was not intended to be about policy, but there is a Senate hearing coming up this week on geoengineering. So you are going to see on C-SPAN this week some of the top experts in the world talking about geoengineering. And I have this little PBS digital series on YouTube called Global Weirding. We have these short videos that address topics, and we have one on geoengineering coming up later this season also. Short answer, geoengineering is the idea of, for example, spraying soot into the atmosphere to mimic the effects of a volcano that temporarily cooled the Earth, or altering the composition of the ocean so it soaks up more carbon dioxide than it would naturally. Geoengineering can also be extremely basic, like planting a ton of trees, which would also soak up the carbon dioxide. So we can't say, you know, a blanket statement, oh, no, we should never do geoengineering. Absolutely not. I think we all support planting trees, right? But when you get into some of the more speculative stuff that we've never done before, then that worries me, because it's like giving every single person on the entire planet the same experimental drug without it ever having been lab tested. So that's why I support studies of geoengineering, because the worst possible thing could be some country unilaterally deciding to do it and us not actually understanding the full impacts. I think it needs a lot more study before we can view it as a viable thing to do, because even though it would temporarily cool temperature, it wouldn't actually affect problems like ocean acidification or changes in the hydrological and the water cycle. It wouldn't affect those. So we would still be dealing with impacts while we had this other thing going on over here.
Bill, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Kelly on the line in Cascade. Kelly, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for covering this topic. I'm delighted. It gives me hope. I feel like this is probably one of the most pressing topics that needs to be covered for our generation and my children and their children, so thank you. My question is, if this is a federal report, who is being required to read it? I feel like our government officials across the board need to have access to this, and I'd love to see it be required reading for all of them, so thank you.
Kelly, thanks for the call. Catherine, the audience for this report.
Well, I would love for it to be required reading, and I can't help but assuming that people might not have read it before approving it, given that it was released by the federal administration under 12 agencies. The answer, though, is this is available now for everybody to read. You can find it online at science2017.globalchange.gov, and it is there for everyone. I wish that we could make all of our leaders read it, but we can't. We live in a free world. But it is there for anyone who wants that information, and that is why I and so many of my colleagues spent our time writing this. We didn't get paid. This is something that I did nights, weekends, 3 a.m. often. We did it because we wanted our best available information to be out there. So anybody who has a question about the science will have access to the most up-to-date science in the world right now at their fingertips at science2017.globalchange.gov.
Thanks for that call, Kelly. We're talking to Catherine Hayhoe from Texas Tech. She's one of the lead authors on a newly released federal report on climate change, its causes, impacts, and possible solutions. Back to your calls now. We've got Simmer on the line in Milwaukee. Simmer, hi.
Hi, Rob, hi, Catherine. Thank you for keeping the show going. I just have a question regarding the Paris Climate Accord. We are the only country left that actually pulled out. And what's the impact? I guess, Catherine, you're doing a great job of explaining all of this, as one of the previous callers said. Is like, can you just explain to the masses what actually the Paris Accord was doing?
Simmer, thanks for that. And in the news, Syria just signed on with the last holdouts in Nicaragua. With one of the others has recently signed on. So that, I believe that leaves us as the only nation not in. Sorry to interrupt, Catherine. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Thank you for the update. I mean, isn't that ironic that the U.S. has the most up-to-date climate science report in the entire world, and it's the only country that isn't part of the negotiations that are going on in Bonn right now? So this in Bonn this week is the follow-up to the Paris Agreement. It's essentially like a weigh-in. You know when you're losing weight and you have like a weigh-in to see how good you're doing? That's what the meeting in Bonn is. It's a weigh-in on the Paris Agreement to see here's what all the countries promised they would do. When they met in Paris 2 years ago, every country brought something to the table, kind of like a potluck dinner. One, you know, Bhutan said, we're going to reforest X amount of our country. France said, we're going to work on carbon sequestration in our soil. The United States said, we're going to offer the clean power plant. Everybody brought a different dish to the global potluck on how they were going to reduce their carbon emissions. And at the Paris Agreement, at the Paris meeting, every country in the world agreed to limit global temperature increase to at least 2 degrees Celsius, which is about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, and 1.5 degrees Celsius if we can. Currently, the pledges that have been made are enough to limit warming to 2.8 degrees Celsius. So we're not there yet. And that's why there's follow-on meetings, because we need a little bit more. The table is not full yet. We don't have everything on the table that we need to meet the agreement that people set. But here's the good news for the U.S. It's true that the U.S. is not in as a country, but there's this movement you might have heard of called We're Still In. It has been joined by cities, by businesses, by states, and soon it's going to be available for individual people to join. And so far, I think somewhere around 40% of U.S. emissions, people, businesses, cities, states, responsible for 40% of U.S. emissions, give or take, they have already committed to meet their Paris Agreement targets. So just because the federal government isn't in doesn't mean that we can't be in, and many of us are.
Simmer, thanks for that call. And briefly, Catherine, as we wrap up, as you said at the outset, a lot of the science news is bad. You sound optimistic. Why?
I don't get my hope from looking at the science. I get my hope from looking at what people are doing. It is amazing how the clean energy economy is expanding and growing. In China, where they're flooding open pit coal mines and putting floating solar panels on the top. In Saudi Arabia, where they're talking about how they can turn their economy from fossil fuels to clean energy. And where I live in Texas, where they're putting up new wind turbines every time you turn around. The world is changing. And I get my hope from looking at what people are doing, including the fact that we have a bipartisan climate solutions caucus in Congress that supports putting a price on carbon, and it has 60 members, half of them Republican, half Democrat, because you're not allowed to join unless you join with somebody from the other party. So even in Washington, things are starting to change.
Catherine, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Catherine Hayhoe, atmospheric scientist and professor in the Political Science Department at Texas Tech University. She's the lead author on a new U.S. federal report on climate change.